He was born in a small Jamaican town, rose to become the most powerful black man on earth, and built a movement that stretched across five continents before being silenced by governments, betrayed by allies, and erased from history books. His name was Marcus Mosiah Garvey. He dreamed of ships, nations, and a unified Africa long before the world was ready. And though they tried to bury his voice, his fire only spread. This is not just a story about one man. It's a story of pride, exile, revolution, and the legacy that refuses to die. Welcome to the History of the Caribbeans podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Marcus Mosiah Garvey, A Journey Through Time, Episode 1. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Echoes of St. Anne's Bay. St. Anne's Bay, Jamaica, 1887. The first cries of Marcus Mosiah Garvey were swallowed by the thick, honeyed air of St. Anne's Bay, a small port town wrapped in emerald hills and bordered by a sea that glittered like shattered glass beneath the Caribbean sun. It was a place of untamed beauty and tightly coiled pain, a land lush with banana trees and sugarcane, where the ghosts of slavery whispered through the rustle of palm fronds. Every grain of earth beneath his feet had once been soaked in the sweat of the enslaved, and though the chains had long since rusted away, the weight of them had never truly vanished. It lingered in the posture of the workers who bent their backs in the fields. It lived in the hush that followed any talk of England, and it lived in the quiet grief of the mothers who knew the world was not made for their sons. Born on August 17, 1887, Marcus entered the world in a wooden house that stood crookedly near the center of town, its tin roof clanging in the wind. His father, Marcus Garvey Sr., was a man of austere silence and stern intellect, a stonemason by trade and a man of books by obsession. He was known to possess more volumes than some local parish schools. He had a stubborn pride in his blackness, a trait he neither softened nor excused. And he instilled this in his children with the quiet force of a tide. His mother, Sarah Jane Richards, was the counterpoint, warm, practical, and God-fearing. She washed for a living, her hands perpetually raw from soap and water, and she prayed constantly, over food, over illness, over the uncertain fate of a black boy in a white-ruled world. Their household was modest but dignified, elevated by a reverence for knowledge and discipline. There were no luxuries, but there were always books. From the age of three, Marcus could be found tracing his fingers over the spines of his father's collection, almanacs, history texts, Latin grammar books, newspapers from England and America. He didn't understand most of it, not yet, but he recognized the power in the printed word. It was in those brittle pages that he first tasted the idea that knowledge could be armor, that truth could be weaponized. Outside their home, life in colonial Jamaica was a study in contradictions. On paper, the island had moved past slavery, but in practice, the color of one's skin still dictated access, opportunity, and value. Lighter-skinned Jamaicans held higher positions and were treated with subtle, consistent preference. The darker one's complexion, the closer to the bottom one lived, socially, economically, and spiritually. The British colonial system was clever in this way. It did not need to chain black men physically if it could chain their minds. The poison of inferiority was administered in small, daily doses, in the churches that hung pictures of a white Christ, in the schools that prioritized European history, and in the courts where black testimony meant little. Young Marcus saw it all. He watched his mother endure disrespect from lighter-skinned employers. He witnessed friends mocked or passed over simply because of their skin tone. But rather than absorb shame, Marcus absorbed fire. He could not articulate it yet, but something stirred in him, a resistance, a refusal. He did not wish to be accepted by the system. He wanted to dismantle it. By the age of 10, Marcus had become a student of the world in ways no classroom could teach. He attended elementary school in St. Anne's Bay, where he was quickly recognized for his sharp mind and powerful command of language. He loved to debate, often taking on classmates and even teachers with a fearlessness that left many stunned. But while he excelled academically, he was never fully embraced. his pride, his skin, and his burgeoning radical awareness made him a solitary figure. He spoke with conviction that seemed too large for his small frame, and it intimidated as much as it inspired. When he was 14, Marcus was forced to leave school to help support his family. His father had fallen into deeper isolation and financial instability, the books no longer enough to shield him from the realities of colonial decay. Marcus found work as a printer's apprentice at a local press, an experience that would shape the rest of his life in ways neither he nor the world yet understood. It was there, in the ink-stained rooms of the printing shop, that he learned the mechanics of production, how newspapers were made, how headlines could stir emotions, how typesetting could spread ideas like wildfire. He began to read more voraciously newspapers, pamphlets, political essays, and revolutionary tracts. He learned of revolts in Haiti, of the Haitian King Christophe and Toussaint Louverture, and of black thinkers in America who wrote of dignity and liberation. One day, while sweeping the floors of the press, he overheard a conversation between two older workers discussing Booker T. Washington. The name stuck with him. Washington's philosophy, advocating for black self-reliance and education, would later become a pivotal influence. But before Garvey could act on any philosophy, he had to survive the disillusionment of his youth. In his late teens, he experienced heartbreak that reshaped his understanding of colorism and class. He fell in love with a young girl in St. Ann's Bay, but her family disapproved of him, not for his intellect nor for his prospects, but for his skin. She was of lighter complexion, and Garvey, though articulate and ambitious, was too black for their liking. The rejection cut deep. It was not just personal. It was ideological. It confirmed to him that even among his own people, the disease of white supremacy had sunk its claws deep. This moment would be one of many foundational betrayals that hardened his vision. He began to see not just individuals, but systems, patterns. He understood that to be a black man in this world was to be measured against a lie, and to dismantle that lie would require more than dreams. It would require an army of minds. As the 19th century turned, so too did the wheels of Marcus Garvey's destiny. Jamaica could no longer contain the fire that was growing in him. He had read of black men and women struggling in Panama, in Costa Rica, in Nicaragua, laboring under cruel conditions and invisible yokes. He longed to see with his own eyes what he had only read about in ink. He began saving money, one coin at a time, while continuing to work as a printer. He knew that his future would not be forged in St. Ann's Bay. The fight was bigger. The struggle was global. And so, with a battered suitcase and a heart full of righteous fury, Marcus Mosiah Garvey prepared to leave the island of his birth. He stood at the dock one morning, staring out at the vast Atlantic, the salty wind whipping through his shirt. He was 23. Behind him lay the warm arms of his mother, the cold disappointment of colonial Jamaica, and the whispers of his ancestors. Before him lay the unknown. But Garvey was not afraid. Not anymore. He did not merely want to find a place in the world. He wanted to change it. Forever. Chapter 2. The Awakening of a Young Mind. 1905, Limon, Costa Rica. The rain came sideways in Limon. Thick, hot, relentless. Less a drizzle, more a wall of water that painted everything in a glossy sheen. It soaked through shirts, pooled in boots, and drowned out idle conversation with its steady drumbeat. To Marcus Mosiah Garvey, just barely past 20 and newly arrived from Jamaica, the rain was more than an inconvenience. It was a baptism. He stood beneath the corrugated metal awning of a shipping office, his suitcase heavy with damp clothes, his stomach grumbling with a kind of hunger that dreams alone could not satisfy. But his eyes were sharp, always sharp. This was not a holiday. This was a fact-finding mission, a pilgrimage, a descent into the underbelly of the black diaspora. In Central America, he would come face to face with the global anatomy of black suffering, how colonialism, capitalism, and racism worked in tandem like a well-oiled machine. The Banana Republics, as they were called with brutal irony, were fertile ground for foreign exploitation. The United Fruit Company loomed like a shadowy titan, swallowing land and lives with the efficiency of a machine. black laborers from Jamaica and other Caribbean islands were imported by the thousands, promised work and stability. What they received instead was misery, low wages, poor housing, racial segregation, and the daily risk of death from machinery, disease, or human cruelty. Garvey had arrived with a vague hope of upward mobility. He had heard rumors of opportunity, of jobs for strong backs and quick minds. What he found was a waking nightmare. Men coughing blood in overcrowded barracks, women laboring under the weight of foreign tongues, children running barefoot through streets that smelled of rot. This was not the promise of better. It was the replication of worse. And it was everywhere. Lee Moan was only the beginning. In the years that followed, Garvey would move across borders like a ghost in pursuit of answers. Costa Rica, Panama, Ecuador, Nicaragua. He took whatever work he could find. Timekeeper for the banana plantations, journalist, laborer, even foreman for a time. Each job gave him a new vantage point from which to observe the machinery of oppression. Each country revealed the same cruel pattern, a fractured world, cleaved by skin color, where black bodies were used until broken and discarded like refuse. What disturbed Garvey most was not just the cruelty of white overseers or foreign executives. That was expected. No, what haunted him was the resignation in the eyes of the black men around him. It was as if they had accepted it, as if they believed this was all they deserved. The colonizer had done more than rob them of land and labor. He had stolen their self-concept. He had replaced pride with shame, ambition with obedience. And yet, amid the dust and despair, Garvey also discovered something else. Something powerful. A potential hidden like a seed beneath scorched earth. The people. Their resilience. Their music, their stories. Even in bondage, their culture thrived. Drums still spoke, tongues still chanted, mothers still passed down histories by firelight. In the darkest places, Garvey saw flickers of something divine, something unbroken. It called to him like a prophecy. It was around this time that Garvey's writing became more frequent, more urgent. He began composing letters, essays, and observations, sending them back to Jamaican newspapers or preserving them in notebooks. He wrote of workers ground down by companies that made millions off their sweat. He described the silent racial hierarchies enforced not just by law, but by habit and violence. And he began to write not only about injustice, but about what might rise in its place. He dreamed of a movement, not a protest, a renaissance. A reclamation of the black spirit that would restore dignity to every man, woman, and child descended from Africa. It would begin not with anger, but with education, not with vengeance, but with vision. He envisioned a people united across oceans and borders, their skin kissed by the same sun, their blood linked by the same history. He began to understand that blackness was not a curse, nor a subcategory of humanity. It was a nation. A scattered, wounded, stateless nation. And every nation needs a leader. The books of his youth came alive again in his mind. Toussaint, Christophe, Booker T. Washington, the bold and the pragmatic, the thinkers and the doers. Garvey began to see himself not as a witness to history, but as a shaper of it. But to shape the world, he needed more than passion. He needed structure. And so in 1912, Garvey left Latin America and returned briefly to Jamaica to gather his bearings. It was clear now that his next step must be academic. He needed to sharpen his ideology. He needed to walk among the architects of empire, not to admire them, but to study their blueprints. London, that cold, gray city on the Thames, had birthed centuries of colonial rule, and Garvey intended to mine it for all its contradictions. He secured passage by ship, scraping together money with the help of friends and former employers, and arrived in England with little more than a winter coat and a furnace in his chest. London was unlike anything Garvey had known. Its architecture was imposing, its streets teeming with horse-drawn carriages, steam trams, and people wrapped in layers of wool. But beneath its civility, Garvey felt the pulse of something familiar, division. It wore different clothes here, carried itself with the aloof sneer of empire, but it was still racism. In the snide comments, in the dismissive glances, in the suffocating superiority of the ruling class. He enrolled in Birkbeck College, where he took courses in law and philosophy by night and worked as a messenger or dock laborer by day. He also joined the African Times and Orient Review, a Pan-African journal edited by Duze Muhammad Ali, a towering figure who would become one of Garvey's earliest mentors. Through this circle, Garvey was introduced to a diaspora of ideas, African nationalists, Indian revolutionaries, black intellectuals from the West Indies and the Americas. They debated colonialism, independence, culture, and sovereignty over tea and cigar smoke in dimly lit cafes. Garvey was electrified. For the first time, he felt surrounded by minds that did not merely survive empire. They challenged it. He consumed every article, every speech, every scrap of revolutionary theory he could find. He read up on ancient African civilizations, Kush, Aksum, Mali, empires erased by white textbooks, but roaring in black memory. He discovered the writings of Edward Wilmot Blyden, a Liberian scholar who proposed African redemption through cultural pride. And he studied Washington's Up from Slavery like scripture, admiring its call for economic independence, but noting its limitations too. It was in London, during a late walk by the Thames, that the question struck him like thunder. Where is the black man's government? Where is his king and his kingdom? Where is his president, his country, his men of big affairs? And the answer was silence. Not because black people had never ruled, but because history had been edited, their legacies scattered, forgotten, buried under layers of white narrative. That silence was unacceptable. That silence was where Marcus Mosiah Garvey would plant his flag. He resolved, then and there, to dedicate his life to the resurrection of a lost nation. Not a dream, not a metaphor, but a real, physical, global movement. He would not wait for Europe to respect the African. He would command it. He would awaken black people across the globe to their own power and divinity. The ink of oppression would be rewritten with fire. The child of St. Anne's Bay had come a long way. He was no longer just a thinker. He was becoming a visionary. A storm was brewing on the edge of the Atlantic, and Marcus Garvey was ready to ride it. Chapter 3, Across Continents, Across Chains, 1906 to 1912, The Journey of a Restless Prophet. The world had never looked so wide. From the deck of a rust-streaked steamship slicing through Caribbean waters, Marcus Mosiah Garvey stood with his hands gripping the rail and his eyes fixed on the horizon, a horizon that kept shifting, as though daring him to chase it. The sea rolled beneath him like a living beast, gray-green and wild, and the air stung with salt and promise. His suitcase held few clothes, but many papers, notes, letters, headlines, sketches of thoughts he hadn't yet spoken aloud. Garvey had left Jamaica because the island had become too small for the size of his questions. The rhythms of St. Anne's Bay were burned into his bones, but now he needed more than rhythm. He needed evidence. He needed to see if the suffering he had witnessed in Jamaica was an isolated wound, or if it was, in fact, a systemic affliction, a global sickness with many masks, but a single poisoned root. He would not be disappointed. His journey would stretch across 6 years and span multiple nations, taking him into the bellies of empires masquerading as economies. From Costa Rica's humid plantations to Panama's perilous canal zones, from the docks of Nicaragua to the chaos of Ecuador, Garvey would come face to face with a singular, undeniable truth. Wherever black people lived, they lived beneath a boot. Costa Rica, the Gilded Cage. Limon was more than a port, it was a crucible. Beneath its canopy of banana trees and its rows of corrugated tin homes, thousands of Jamaican laborers toiled under the rule of American fruit magnates. The United Fruit Company was a silent empire. It didn't need armies or flags. Its weapon was commerce, and its strategy was simple. Exploit the land, exploit the people, and wrap it all in the language of opportunity. Garvey took a job as a timekeeper, one of the few black men allowed to hold a position of clerical oversight. From his small wooden desk, he logged hours for hundreds of men, many of them worn thin by the demands of endless labor. He watched them line up in mud-cake boots, shoulders slumped, faces hardened into masks of quiet despair. They came to him with fingers missing, eyes red from pesticide exposure, bodies twisted by injury. The company offered no benefits, no safety net, no future. Only the next day's shift. Garvey spoke to them during breaks. At first, they were suspicious, accustomed to betrayal, slow to trust anyone with ink on their fingers instead of dirt. But he listened. He asked questions. And he began to write. He chronicled their conditions in letters to newspapers back in Jamaica. He documented the racial hierarchies at play, the humiliations endured, the stories the world refused to hear. But more importantly, he began to formulate a thesis, a unifying idea that would serve as the cornerstone of his life's work. This suffering is not natural. It is designed. Panama, death in the ditch. In 1907, Garvey traveled to Panama, then a boiling pot of foreign interests. The Americans had taken over the construction of the Panama Canal, and with them came a brutal racial order. White Americans at the top, followed by white Panamanians, mestizos, and at the very bottom, black West Indian laborers brought in from Jamaica, Barbados, and Trinidad. They were paid in silver, literally. The color of your wage determined your worth. Gold roll workers were white and earned more, lived in cleaner quarters, and had access to better food and medical care. Silver roll workers, who were almost exclusively black, were housed in crowded barracks, fed spoiled rations, and denied basic protections. They dug the canal by hand, waist-deep in mosquito-infested ditches, often collapsing from heat or disease. Garvey didn't just observe this. He breathed it. He walked among the workers, sat with them during mealtimes, heard their prayers for survival. He saw men buried without ceremony after succumbing to malaria or yellow fever. He saw women denied care because of their skin. And he watched as America built its symbol of engineering greatness on a mountain of black bones. This wasn't injustice. It was genocide by bureaucracy. Garvey burned with rage, but not aimless rage. A focused, calculated fury. It was here that his ideas began to crystallize. If the black man had no nation, no army, no government of his own, he would always be vulnerable to extermination. Nicaragua and Ecuador. The betrayals multiply. As the years rolled on, Garvey moved like a restless spirit across Central and South America. He took short-term jobs on wharves and sugar estates, often under assumed names to avoid reprisal for his outspokenness. In Nicaragua, he saw British firms dominate the trade while local Afro-descendants were pushed to the margins of commerce. In Ecuador, he was struck by the invisibility of black communities, present, yet silenced by cultural erasure. Each place he visited echoed the same chorus: exploitation, disenfranchisement, and abandonment. But each place also contained resistance. He met men and women who ran clandestine schools for black children. He met street preachers who called out racism in the language of scripture. He met midwives who preserved African herbal knowledge in secret. He realized that black identity was not a relic, it was a force. But it was scattered, disconnected, like embers waiting for wind. And he intended to be that wind, the letters that changed everything. It was in the midst of this journey, likely in a cramped boarding house with a flickering oil lamp, that Garvey began corresponding with a man he had long admired, Booker T. Washington. Washington's book Up From Slavery had been one of the few black-authored texts available to Garvey during his youth, and it had planted seeds of ambition and practicality. Washington advocated for black self-reliance, economic development, and industrial education, not revolution, but elevation through discipline and unity. Garvey wrote to him with respect and admiration, sharing his own experiences across Latin America and the Caribbean. To his astonishment, Washington responded. The correspondence was brief but impactful. Though Washington would pass away in 1915 before Garvey could meet him, the exchange had lit a torch in Garvey's mind. Perhaps, in the Americas, there was room to build something. Perhaps his voice could carry farther than just newspaper columns and speeches to laborers. A new theory of the world. By 1912, Marcus Garvey was no longer just a young man seeking answers. He was a man possessed by a vision. He had seen too much, endured too much, and learned too much to remain silent. The suffering he'd witnessed was not the natural order. It was policy. It was strategy. And it could be undone with counter-strategy, with counter-narratives, with leadership. His theory of Pan-Africanism was no longer academic. It was urgent. He began to sketch out a blueprint, a global black movement rooted in pride, powered by commerce, protected by solidarity. No more waiting for white sympathy. No more begging for entry into white institutions. Garvey envisioned schools, businesses, and newspapers created by black hands for black futures. He envisioned a united Africa as both a homeland and a symbol, an empire reborn, not ruled. This was no fantasy. It was survival. He returned to Jamaica in 1912 with this conviction burning inside him and quickly realized the island was not yet ready for what he had become. His people were suffering. Yes, but they had been taught to suffer quietly, even gratefully. That, too, would have to change. The next horizon. One evening, standing once again at the harbor in Kingston, Garvey looked out at the sea, not as a wanderer, but as a man preparing for war. Not a war of bullets, but a war of symbols, of systems, of ideas. He was no longer a passive observer of history. He was its author now, and he knew where he had to go next. To the heart of the empire. To London. Chapter 4, London Nights and African Dreams. 1912 to 1914, The Education of a Revolutionary Mind. London greeted Marcus Mosiah Garvey with smoke in its lungs and arrogance in its bones. It was the kind of city that did not so much welcome a man as dare him to survive it. Gray skies smothered the skyline like ash, and the fog, thick, wet, choking, crawled into every alley and crevice. The Thames moved like an ancient serpent, sluggish and foul-smelling, weaving between buildings that bore centuries of empire on their soot-covered facades. To most travelers from the colonies, London was the promised land of order, education, and advancement. But Garvey had not come to marvel. He had come to interrogate the empire at its source. And from the moment his boots hit the pavement at Southampton Docks, he felt the weight of its indifference pressing down. London, for all its grandeur, had a strange emptiness to it, a spiritual sterility that Garvey could feel in his chest. The streets were wider, yes. The buildings were taller, yes. But the faces, the eyes, cold, rushed distant. Here, Garvey was no longer just a Jamaican. He was a shadow among millions, a man of color in a city that barely acknowledged his existence, unless to sneer at it. The racism in London was not loud, not violent, at least not at first. It was subtle, lethal in its politeness. Doors closed without explanation. Jobs rejected without cause. Conversations cut short. Every smile forced. Every nod, a gesture of reluctant tolerance. Still, Garvey endured. He found a room in Notting Hill, at the time a working-class district thick with fog and the smell of coal fires. His landlord, a half-senile Irish widow, was suspicious of him but needed the rent. The room was damp, with a single small window and a rusted gas lamp that hissed more than it glowed. But Garvey made it a temple. On one wall, he tacked up a map of Africa. On the other, a worn portrait of Booker T. Washington. In the evenings, by candlelight, he would read and write until the early hours, wrapped in blankets, breath visible in the frigid air. By day, he worked wherever he could. He took up positions as a messenger, a handyman, a porter at a publishing office. Often, he went hungry, choosing to spend his scarce coins on newspapers, used books, and transportation to lectures or libraries. He walked miles across the city in worn shoes, chasing knowledge like a starving man chases food. And when the city finally began to feed him, it did so in ways no university curriculum ever could. The streets as a classroom. Garvey enrolled in classes at Birkbeck College, a night school known for serving working-class men who sought higher education without privilege. There, he studied law, philosophy, and political science. He absorbed everything with a fierce hunger: legal theory, economic structures, global history. But even as he sat among books and professors, he never allowed himself to be lulled into believing that empire could be explained in theory alone. He saw it outside, in the way colonial soldiers, black and brown men from India, Africa, and the Caribbean, were paraded like trophies through the streets. In the way African students were expected to emulate European customs, speak in hushed tones, and be grateful for the civilization offered to them. In the way the British press spoke of uprisings in the colonies with disdain, reducing legitimate demands for freedom to acts of savagery. It became clear to Garvey that the British Empire was not just a system of control. It was a theology, a gospel of white supremacy dressed in the robes of civility. But beneath the suffocating atmosphere of colonial pride, London held a different current too, one that whispered of rebellion and vision. Duze Muhammad Ali, the catalyst. In 1913, Garvey was introduced to Duze Muhammad Ali, an Egyptian-Sudanese intellectual, journalist, and Pan-Africanist who had founded the African Times and Orient Review. Ali was a force of nature, a man of immense charisma and immense intellect, fluent in several languages and unafraid to call out the hypocrisy of British rule. He believed that Africa could and must liberate itself through unity, culture, and communication. Garvey was immediately drawn to him. Ali offered Garvey a position as assistant editor at the journal. It was more than a job, it was a crucible. Through the journal, Garvey was exposed to a tapestry of global anti-colonial thought. He read about the rise of Indian nationalism, the struggle for Irish independence, and the Haitian Revolution in tones of reverence. He engaged in deep conversations with African students, Middle Eastern activists, and Caribbean intellectuals who passed through the cramped offices of the publication. It was here that Garvey's mind exploded outward. Here, he connected the dots between local injustice and global oppression. Here, he began to refine his dream of Pan-Africanism, not as a romantic ideal, but as a tangible, structured, urgent necessity. And here, too, he began to develop his voice. His editorials were electric, blistering critiques of colonialism, eloquent tributes to African heritage, and fiery calls for self-determination. He signed them not with hesitation, but with pride. Marcus Mosiah Garvey, Son of Africa. The Ghosts of Greatness. But Garvey did not only read the future. He also studied the past. At the British Museum, surrounded by ancient tomes and stolen artifacts, Garvey pored over the history of African civilizations that had been scrubbed from Western curricula. He read of Timbuktu, once home to libraries and universities while Europe wallowed in the Dark Ages. He studied the Malian Empire, the wealth of Mansa Musa, the brilliance of Kemet, ancient Egypt. He realized that Africa's history had not been erased due to lack of significance, but precisely because of its magnificence. A colonizer's greatest weapon, he understood now, was not the whip, but the eraser. And so, Garvey took up arms in the form of ink. He began drafting a manuscript, a sweeping text that outlined a future where black people across the globe would rise, reconnect with their ancestry, and reclaim their rightful place in history. He titled it The Philosophy and Opinions of Marcus Garvey, the question that changed everything. One night, while walking alone along the Thames, his breath forming clouds in the cold, Garvey stopped beneath a flickering gaslight and stared into the black waters. The wind howled. The street was deserted. And then the question came. Where is the black man's government? Where is his king and his kingdom? Where is his president, his country, his men of big affairs? The answer was silence. Not because these things had never existed, but because they had been systematically destroyed, ignored, or co-opted. And in that silence, Garvey made a vow. If the world refused to acknowledge the greatness of black people, he would force it to. If there was no king, he would crown one. If there was no nation, he would build one. Not someday. Now, the seed of a movement. In 1914, after 2 years of study, struggle, and self-discovery, Garvey returned to Jamaica. He was not the man who had left. He walked differently now, spoke differently, his shoulders squared, his eyes sharper, his mission no longer a mere dream, but a mandate. The vision was fully formed. A global organization that would uplift the black race through education, commerce, industry, and pride. An empire without walls. A brotherhood without borders. He would call it the Universal Negro Improvement Association. He did not know yet how it would grow or how it would be attacked, but he knew this. The world had changed him. Now he would change the world.